You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. 'Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar.
This episode is brought to you by our patron, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek.
Hello, you're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast. I'm your host, Wes, and with me today is...
Chris.
And...
Oren.
And today we're going to be talking to you about Game Master Inspiration. And inspiration, of course, is defined as the act of inhaling or breathing, right? Drawing fresh air into your lungs.
It is really important when you're GMing to breathe.
Yes.
You know, I don't think your campaign would go very well if you don't breathe. I think that would be a problem.
And that is something to keep in mind because, yes, we're not clowning around. Inspiration means to inhale, but we get our more common definition as in breathing life into your mind or soul, an infusion of an idea that makes you want to go do something cool. And in this case, make fun games.
Is that really the origin of the... of our use of inspiration?
Yes, yes, actually, like the inspiration's opposite is, I think it's expiration. So it's like inhalation, exhalation, inspiration, expiration. And yeah, that's where like we get that, the act of inspiring, breathing, but then it goes into like inspiring your mind. Well, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's very poetic.
About that, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a very serious question. I sometimes have, like, too much inspiration where I'm trying to work, and my brain is like, hey, dude, how about another magic system? And I'm like, no, I have to work now. But I can't not think about that other magic system. How do I expirate that idea? How do I get it out? How do I make it leave?
You really can't just, like, inhale through, like, a paper bag in that case, really, can you?
No, not so much. Okay, so Chris, you are the one of the three of us that is currently running a game.
A fantastic game.
Yes, it is a very excellent game, and if we say that enough, maybe she'll give us some extra experience. So Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about your game and what your inspiration for running it was?
Okay, so I will say that I am running the game because of inspiration. I know a lot of other people who GM regularly... well, they'll want to run a game and then they'll look for what kind of game they're running. And, this is my very first campaign. And so I started it just because I just got that story bug, but this particular story is something that had to be told through, role playing. And it's kind of hard to pin down the reason why. It's like, when you get inspiration, you know, sometimes to me it's like, no, this has to be like in a visual medium, despite the fact that like I have no illustration skills or like video skills or anything. And sometimes, you know, and I'm not always certain why that piece of inspiration was matched to a particular medium. But I think the thing that really is different about role playing is, so all stories are, I think, about conveying a certain experience to the audience. But I think with role playing, that's a lot more obvious. Right? Because if you're GMing, your players are right at the table, you know, you get to actually see them have that experience. Whereas with other forms of storytelling, it's a lot more remote. There's a lot bigger divide between you and your audience. And so, like, I wanted to give people who were with me a specific experience. And that was kind of like a specific atmosphere. And I've been pretty satisfied. I think so far I've actually accomplished the sort of super mysterious, kind of eerie atmosphere that I was going for, at least in some scenes.
Mm-hmm. I would absolutely agree. And, like, was there anything in particular that, like, happened that, like, made you want to run it, or did like, the idea just, like, pop fully formed into your head?
I mean, the obvious thing is Teen Wolf. So, I mean, okay, so it's a teen monster game. You know, would be the closest kind of like genre. And so, you know, I'd been watching Teen Wolf, and I think that is the most obvious thing. And You know, my players certainly all assumed that it was directly inspired by Teen Wolf. And then, I was very surprised then my players decided they're all going to go watch Teen Wolf, which I was not expecting. But I think it's very indirect. It's like, well, I think Teen Wolf was initially that instigator, but it's really that atmosphere. But I think Teen Wolf does, in part of it, it does do a good job with that. I think particularly in like season one, which is really what sets it apart from Buffy. Because Buffy has a super like campy atmosphere. And they go for spooky, but it's never really that spooky or mysterious. Whereas Teen Wolf is much less campy than Buffy and really manages to have that kind of like creepy, eerie atmosphere somewhat, especially in season one, when of course you don't really know what's going on, which is part of the reason why my campaign is designed to end, you know, at a specific point, like once all the players get their bearings, then the game ends, because it's that transition period that is really like disorienting and mysterious. And once you are acclimated to, you know, having been bitten by a monster and becoming a monster, you don't really have, you know, you have to kind of transition to something else. It's hard to get that spooky atmosphere to be the same as it was when the story started.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the Teen Wolf experience would be complete unless we went on for five more, like, arcs, and each time you kept two of the villains from last time and made them new characters.
Oh my gosh, I cannot imagine, like, every like, hey, here's a big bad. The players kill the big bad. Then, like, next session, oh, that big bad you killed? Not really dead.
No. Oh, God. Players hate that.
Yeah.
I took over the GMing position from somebody else who had apparently done that, where, like, the players thought they'd killed a boss by, like, shooting him in the head. And he, like, brought the boss back, and his explanation was like, he's got some weird cybernetic brain stuff. And at that point, like, I took me a while to figure this out, and I found out because my players kept, like, decapitating and dismembering the corpses of enemies they killed. and I was like, why are you doing that? What is happening? And they were like, well, we want to make sure they don't come back. And I was like, I promise I won't do that. Can you please stop?
God, that's great. I used to think that just looting was like enough. I guess not.
Like, burn the body, salt the grave it seems to be the watchword here. But so TV shows in particular are a really great source of inspiration for a few reasons. One is that they are by definition in a episodic format, right? And so are most role-playing games. You're going to be playing them, you know, usually once a week and for several hours at a time, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And an RPG session doesn't have to have exactly the same, like, you know, fractal arc that a television show episode does, because you can get a lot more mileage out of just, like, enjoying being your character and exploring the world in a way that might not be fun to an outside observer. But there's still a value to having smaller stories nested within a larger story, and television shows can give you that idea. Television shows also have, in most cases, more of an ensemble cast, which is important. Because, you know, role-playing games are shared equally among a number of players, and if your inspiration comes entirely from novels and stories, then you might have difficulty because you're really used to, like, well, you're the main character, and it's like, what about your other four players? You know, they also want to be the main character.
Yeah.
Definitely TV shows are a good way to go.
I'm a big fan of the TV shows that, like, feel like they were adapted from RPGs. Like, you know, like, Supernatural certainly has its flaws, but, like, it is also a very clear representation of the Hunter RPG, like, on television. And then, like, Leverage is very similar to a game of Spycraft. There are some very clear similarities. And then there are other shows that make great role-playing games, but have never, like, either don't have a system, or the system they have is not, you know, is not very good. So, like, Avatar, for instance. Avatar is, like, feels like it was designed to be a role-playing game, because you've got, like, your group of characters, each with their own, like, weird eccentric power that, like, have their own motivations and, like, are on, like, an overarching quest, but, like, stop to do random stuff every once in a while. You know, that's, like, this is a perfect role-playing material right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting with Avatar because Avatar even has, like, the Chosen One character, basically. But it still puts a lot of emphasis on other characters and makes those other characters, like, powerful and interesting and have their own role. And when you actually ran an Avatar game, people weren't actually jumping up and down to, like, get the Avatar position. Like, you know, you basically asked your most cooperative player, like, is it okay if you're the Avatar?
Yeah, people
weren't... nobody was volunteering, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, I've actually run two Avatar games. In the first one, the Avatar was dead. Right? This was during, like, the, you know, the 16-year period where there is no Avatar. Mm-hmm. And then the second one, the one that you played in, did have an Avatar, and you're right. Like, I actually had to ask to be like, hey, can... would you be the Avatar? Because that nobody else wanted to be the Avatar. It was very... I was very surprised.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I ran what ended up being a one shot that was like trying to like take Avatar and just build it into a system that I already knew, which at the time happened to be D&D 3.5.
Oh, so, okay.
And but I made nobody the Avatar. Instead, it was that the Avatar was just too beleaguered with work and needed to have four representatives from the four like tribes that could actually like do her work for her because like so much was going on. Yeah. No, it's a fun setting. You're right. Like it definitely lends itself well to just like random adventuring and like going around and doing stuff and finding MacGuffins and things.
And like it also helps because it's a diverse setting. There's lots of different stuff going on, but it also has like a number of relatively easy modes of transit that you can use. So like you don't have to spend, you know, a huge amount of time in desert land. If you're done with desert land, now you can hop on your air bike and like go to earth land or water land, right? Water land? Yeah.
Sure.
and it's just very, it's valuable for those reasons, and it has like a fairly well-defined set of magic powers, which is even more handy, because one of the biggest problems with a lot of, you know, inspiration is that the magic and tech gets out of control. So yeah, it's just great for all of those reasons.
Yeah. Another, I think, story that's notable for having an ensemble cast and having a particular formula for combining them is Star Trek. Because Star Trek has, you know, you have your specific ship set up and you have a large cast, but they all have, like, really well-defined roles. You know, and Star Trek doesn't always do a great job of managing them, but has anybody run Star Trek? Does that translate well?
Yeah, I've run it a few times. Specifically, the biggest problem when you're running a Star Trek-type game is dealing with the chain of command. Just because, like, it's kind of inherently difficult to one PC in charge of other PCs, that can lead to a lot of problems. But it's manageable. Like, you can do it. You know, and then the other problem is, of course, all the tech. But the basic idea of, like, flying a ship around and, like, doing adventures in the future, like, that works really well, even if you're not running it in exactly a Star Trek setting, right? Like, you know, that kind of inspiration is very valuable.
Yeah.
One type of inspiration that I think I wish there was more of, but that not a lot of creators seem to be great at, is inspiration that comes from the book, the RPG book itself.
You mean like based on mechanics?
Mechanics or flavor or some combination of the two. Like, you know, like when I read the Torchbearer book or the Mouse Guard book, I get like really fired up to play those games. And I have all these ideas of what I could do with them, much of which is departing pretty radically from what's in the book. But the book gives me, you know, a strong basis and makes me interested. It's like, well, what if you ran Mouse Guard, except that, like, the Mouse Guard was a parallel for overreaching state control, and the towns were a parallel for abusive corporate ownership. And what if you did that, and also squirrels, you know? Like, you know, I've run that game. That was fun.
Go ahead.
And it's not that those books are perfect. Both those games have problems. But, like, reading them was like, I can do so many things with this. In fact, when I compared reading the Mouse Guard RPG book to reading the actual comics, the comics did not come off favorably. Like, when I read them, I was like, this world actually feels kind of slow and not very well built when I read the comics. But then I read the RPG book, and I was like, this is amazing, and I love everything about it. And the advantage of getting inspiration from a role-playing book is that it's designed to be a role-playing game. You know, you don't have to do nearly as much conversion in your head from some other medium.
You want to, one of the things that, since you brought up the RPG books, one of the things that I found was notable, like, I like that, you know, they'll contain maps and art, like, that can definitely be inspiring, or, like, snippets or descriptions, but oftentimes, like, supplemental books can be better for that. But one thing that I thought was, like, oh, yeah, obviously they should do this. I like it when they provide, like, reading lists. That was something that I think was new in, like, the 5th edition for the D&D books in the Dungeon Master's Guide and the Player's Handbook. They have a list of just books at the end of it on, like, the last page of things, mm-hmm. things that the writers, like, thought would be, like, good things to read for inspiration. And I was like, oh, well, I love reading lists. Like, not all of these things are great, but certainly it's like, oh, maybe I can check these out and see what they work. And I mean, obviously so many of, like, the stories that we read, that we play, have their origins in books, right? If you're doing anything mm-hmm. with elves and orcs, you're probably drawing on the inspiration from the Lord of the Rings. But I mean, I don't know, like, reading lists definitely convey a lot of that information or inspiration for me. I mean, I imagine you guys too have found some inspiration from particular books.
Well, here's a question, actually. So yeah. the reading lists, and not just reading lists, of course, they also generally provide other mediums like films or comics or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have never actually looked at one of those and been like, okay, I'm going to read a book in preparation for this game.
Oh, yeah?
Have you? But you have done that.
Yeah.
That is really fascinating.
Well, so, I mean, I don't know. I just, I'm always, like, kind of looking around for new books to pick up. And this, I'm not so into series, so I'm kind of always looking for, like, new ones, you know, just mm-hmm. like little standalone novels and stuff. And, you know, that's been kind of just something to, like, take a photo of or write down a list. And so next time I'm browsing, like, a used bookstore,
okay,
that can be pretty fun. I ended up reading this really, really obscure trilogy, because of, I think it was in the Dungeon Master's Guide, and it's Mervyn Peake's Gormenghast trilogy, which was, like, written in the 60s, and it's so obtuse and weird, and like, but I mean, I read all of it and I enjoyed it. But I mean, if anybody out there is like, oh, I'll check that out, warning, there's no plot, and basically the castle is the main character. So if you like reading long romantic gothic descriptions of things like I do, you'll like it. If you're if you're more normal, you'll hate it.
Wow, that castle has some fine arches, let me tell you.
But yeah, I mean, it's also fun though with lists like that, when you read a list and you kind of go through it and you're like, I've read that, you know, it's like, oh, they're saying that these are books that are like inspiring, and you're like, well, okay, I've read all of them, so good for me.
Yeah, I think it does provide a good reference point to know what the game creator thought the game was good for. Does it mean it's always accurate?
right.
But it's nice to have that reference point. And I think increasingly, you know, I think the way that role-playing games are sold is based on the sort of premise and atmosphere of the game, and usually the beginning of the book with a reading list and the flavor text, and often, like, some opening fiction, is all designed to, like, sell the game based on those kinds of theme and atmosphere that you would get. Mm-hmm. And I kind of assumed that everybody skipped past that stuff and nobody read it, but asking around, you know, I've a surprising number of people do seem to actually read through that material and like it, and that provides value.
Well, it's fun because, I mean, depending on what, you know, type of story you're running, you know, if you're doing, like, a vampire adventure, and, you know, you can mention, what's her name? Mina. Like, you just have a random NPC show up named Mina, and it's kind of a nod to Bram Stoker's Dracula, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, if people have read that book, they might pick up on, like, fun references, which maybe have inspired you. And in, like, that shared storytelling medium that an RPG takes, it's nice when your players get your references, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, really stoked, they fall flat. Know? Yeah.
One thing that the reading list has provided that I have found useful is, if it has something on it that I've already read or watched, that gives me, like, oh, so it's supposed to be like that. Mm. Okay, like now, I, like, you know, like, I was reading Spycraft, like, way back in the day, and I was having a little bit of trouble figuring out, like, how this clicks, because I haven't, like, I wasn't a big James Bond fan or anything like that, right? So when I got to the, like, to the the reading list, one of the things on there was the Ocean's 11 film, which I had seen, and I was mm-hmm. like, oh, okay, so it doesn't just have to be spies, it's about, like, people with exciting skills working as a team to accomplish some covert objective, right? And so that helped me out, right? Like, that gave me ideas.
Have you guys ever gotten ideas from some pre-made campaigns?
Pre-made campaigns.
Wow. I mean, I've run pre-made campaigns. And I guess, I don't know if I've ever fully fleshed anything out. I definitely have gotten some inspiration. Did I act on it? Probably not.
So, yeah. I have never run a pre-made campaign. Or at least, I mean, that's not true. I have. I haven't done it for a long time because I found that I don't like it because, like, I have very specific needs when I'm running campaigns. And, like, by the time I have altered a pre-made campaign to fit those needs, I might as well just made it myself. I have found very useful, like, miniature settings. Like, for example, back when I used to run Legend of the Five Rings all the time, there was this, this village booklet that they had that was like, this is a village, this is everything in the village, and like,
yeah,
there are some plot threads, and like, different people will find different parts of this useful. Like, you know, it had a lot of stats in it that I never used because I usually wing stats anyway, but what it did have that I found very useful was maps. I'm so bad at maps, you guys. Oh my god. You don't know how bad at maps I am. And so this village had maps in it. I was like, okay, so there are like 5 houses on the block around the blacksmith's shop. That's like useful to know, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, made it so much easier to describe what was happening. And so I have shamelessly recycled that village for a number of L5R games, including the one you were in, Chris. It didn't matter that much because you spent most of your time in the castle, but like... but yeah, I have found like pre-made mini settings to be very, very useful. Pre-made campaigns, not so much, but different people get used to set of different things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm really glad you brought up maps because, I mean, visual anything can like be super inspiring for what you want to do, whether you're looking at really cool art or a map. I think is something that can like not only like give you maybe a setting, but like if you're running like a campaign or adventure that you're kind of doing from scratch in your own system, my friends and I have found great success kind of like taking turns as GMs and each time adding a little bit to this shared map on like a really large piece of construction paper that we just kind of like passed Ooh. Back and forth. And so mm-hmm. basically each adventure, we would kind of like add more detail to the map and try to like spread it out and develop, like it was kind of like co-world building, right? But we were like building worlds based on like stuff in our map that like we really hadn't fleshed out at all. And I mean, we're terrible at drawing, but that doesn't really matter so much because you can just have like a bunch of triangles and say, these are mountains and there's a city in there. What kind of city is in there? And then you can like, you know, kind of use that to build on previous adventures and maybe like play into fleshing out your world together through adventures. So I think in that way, like if you're looking for a way to like maintain your inspiration over time, having like a graphic reinforcement can be really helpful in that way.
Yeah. I also imagine that having other people build it adds some kind of freshness for you. Like it's a world you all built yourself, then everything kind of gets old after a while because you know it so well. But if you have other people adding to it, you know, you don't know those parts as well. So I can imagine that would kind of help keep up your interest.
There was one time, and you know, generally like when I'm running games, I definitely try to always follow the rule of improv, right? Just say yes and let's just go. But a friend of mine was running this adventure for us, and so I hopped in the player role, and I built this like entire area on the premise that we had a home base. It was a monastery like that this group like operated out of. And so my friend runs this adventure, and like you know, what's the starting action is he just burns the place to the ground.
Oh, no!
I was so angry. He's like, oh, I know what'll really jumpstart this adventure. I'll burn it to the ground and they'll go have to go on this wild goose hunt into the desert to try to find who did it. So the funniest thing was, like, that was the last adventure we ran. And that was after, like, doing 8 very successful ones, and then it was my turn after that, and I was like, I don't want to go back, you burned down my home. so be careful.
Yeah, with that kind of shared world, like, before you just, I mean, like, any kind of shared world, before you just, like, eliminate a part of it that somebody likes, you have to, you know, that, you gotta be careful with that.
Yeah.
Definitely. I enjoy, if I'm running, like, a kind of more freeform game where I, like, ask the players, okay, where are you going next? Having a map that, it doesn't have to be pretty, but if it's detailed, that really helps. Because if the players are like, we're going to this place, and I can look at the map, and it's like, okay, that's a bog, and there's, like, the thing for ruins on it. So, like, I've got a bog, and I've got some ruins. Okay, I can build on that. As opposed to, like, the player saying, we head west, and I'm like, what is in the west? I don't know. Conestoga wagons? I mean, what do you want from me? I'm definitely a fan of if either making a map yourself, if you enjoy doing that, and if your players can handle the map that you draw, or, like, you know, the internet exists now. You can go on it and find a lot of pre-made fantasy maps. You know, you can't publish them, but if you're just running it for your own group's enjoyment, then who cares?
I do have, like, some settings that I think would be cool to run role-playing games in. I think that the biggest problem that I have when I try to get inspiration from a setting that I made is that oftentimes, you know, if you have interesting magic, for instance, it's really hard to find a system that will fit. If I have a magic system that allows, like, a player to, like, take their arm off and find a new better arm and install it and get, like, +1 strength on that arm, like, I'm not gonna be able to find a system necessarily that does that. And then it's, you know, becoming a problem.
Yeah, but even with, like, really weird random spells, sometimes, like, just looking through, like, spell lists in games can be inspiration enough. I haven't run it yet, but I do think it'd be really fun. There's, like, there's a druids, right? And they get an awakened spell, which basically, like, grants, like, decent intelligence to animals.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just thinking about just, like, you know, this, like, small town suddenly gets, like, besieged by, like, the local wildlife because some druid has gone rogue and he's just like, down with the meat industry, you will not abuse these animals anymore, right? And he's just, like, awakening everything, and all the animals are like, wait, they do what to us?
Like, this will not stand.
This will not stand. The cows rebel. Yes.
Careful. Yeah. All of your players will want to play animals. So.
They absolutely will. Oh, man. I have had this exact same process. Can I tell you all about the Necro-Industrial Complex?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, go
please,
for it.
Please do.
Okay. So in Dungeons & Dragons, in 3.5, and I'm pretty sure in Pathfinder 2, like, Animate Dead, I think is the spell, just, like, creates a skeleton that it lasts forever, and its material components are a corpse and an opal that costs, like, 40 gold pieces, I think. And it's, like, it's more for if you want more hit dice on your skeleton, but for these purposes, you do not need more hit dice. One skeleton will do ya, or a one-hit die skeleton. Because a one-hit die skeleton can do basically everything a person can do in terms of labor, and doesn't have to sleep, doesn't eat, doesn't need paying. It's just infinite work, and it lasts forever, except for, like, if you have an accident or something, right? So it's really easy to imagine a world in which wizards industrialize that. And what you end up with is, like, just everything is run by skeleton power. And, like, the, you know, you have, like, people are carried around on, like, buses lifted by skeletons, and, like, skeletons turn cranks to perform the jobs that, like, normally you would need a steam engine to do, and it doesn't, like, require, you know, industrial pollutants or anything. So, other than the fact that you've got all these skeletons running around, it, like, seems like a utopia.
Oh my god. That is but so if, good.
If you want to introduce conflict into it, you can just have your necro-utopia if you want to. Like, that's but if you want to introduce conflict into it, you have what I call global negativing. Because skeletons and other undead run off of negative energy, which D&D establishes somewhere in its, like, millions of splat books, that negative energy has a deleterious effect on living things. It, like, makes people sick, and it, or, like, encourages bad emotions, and just in general causes problems, right? Now, normally this doesn't matter because negative energy all lives on the negative energy plane, not in the material plane, and, but no energy transaction is 100% efficient, right? There's always some leakage. So when you have an entire world that's run off of literally billions of skeletons, the amount of negative energy that leaks out eventually starts to build up. And so you have sudden outbreaks of sickness for no reason, and like random street violence starts to rise. And in really, really bad areas, you have like portals opening to the lower realms. And it's like, it's because of the increasing levels of negative energy in the material plane. But of course, the Necro Barons suppress those studies, right? And like, talk about how the world has always had high levels of negative energy. And there's no reason to think that any of the current problems are like artificial or wizard created or anything like that. So can your heroes break the world's dependency on necromancy before it's too late?
Oh man. I hope everybody and listening, you need to write this all down, and everybody listening needs to just do everybody just go do adventures in this world and let us know how it turns out.
I don't know if I'll ever run this game because it's very specific to D&D, right?
Yeah. That's but it, great.
But anyway, that's my idea, and I'm sorry, I took us over our time. So do you two have anything you want to finish up with before we call this episode to a close?
I don't think I can top that, Oren. I don't think I can top skeleton necro industrialized world.
Can't break that wheel. No one would want to have those jobs again.
All right. Well, thank you both for talking to me about this and letting me talk about the global necro-industrial complex. And those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythcreants.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week. Mythcreants is free, but the fairy dust and antimatter we feed on isn't. Help us out by going to patreon.com/mythcreants. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess who saved herself. This has been the Mythgreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself by Jonathan Colton.